antidepressants and insulin by the end. Nothing had any effect. He holds up a data drive, the same one plugged into my tablet. All of our data is on here. He sets the drive down and looks into the camera again. The first deaths occurred 8 hours after we entered the cave. We fell like dominoes after that. It was like a bomb went off. Our first instinct was to take everyone back to Carthage City and put them in stasis. But the herds had destroyed most of the buildings, and none of the troops were responding. Even if we found the stasis equipment intact, it would have taken days, maybe weeks, to get everyone into stasis. And the Ereks were still everywhere. Going back would have been certain death. And worse, if you found some of our infected corpses, whatever this is would spread to you. Harry takes a deep breath and glances away from the camera. I thought about trying to get back to Carthage City just to leave a message for you, to warn you about the caves and the sponges, but I would have never gotten past the Ereks. Not even sure I would have made it anyway. At the rate we're dying, we've determined that we don't have much time left. Certainly not enough to find a cure. He brings a hand up, covering his mouth as he coughs. Our only hope was to get away from the regolith sponges and hope the disease went away. We covered the mouth of the cave with rocks to prevent anyone else from finding it, and we left. We couldn't go west, so we went east, to this cave. I knew it didn't have the regolith sponges. I hoped that maybe just being away from the sponges might cure us. So much for that idea. He shrugs, a sad smile on his lips. James, you've got to stay out of the caves at the base of the eastern mountains, and the regolith sponges are probably in other caves too. I think maybe it's too cold for them here in this cave, or maybe there's a predator that feeds on them here. If someone from Jericho gets infected by the sponges, I hope the data we collected helps you find a cure. I don't know if you can contract the disease from our corpses, but the best advice I can give you, James, is to quarantine yourself until you're sure you haven't been infected. And whatever you do, don't go in those caves.
Chapter 9. Emma. The sound of the herd blots out everything else. In the command post, Brightwell's mouth is moving, but it's like I'm watching a movie that's been muted. She's talking to the technicians, but all I hear is the herd barreling toward us. Finally, she steps back and draws a hand across her neck in a kill motion. The technicians in the domed building scramble to turn off every machine, then race for the barracks. They don't have suits to hide their body heat from the Ereks. But I do. So does Brightwell. To me, she holds up three fingers on one hand and makes an O with the other. 30 seconds. 30 seconds until the herd reaches us. Brightwell pulls on a face mask that covers her entire face except for the two pieces of plastic where the eyes are. From the outside, the eyes look black, but you can see perfectly from the inside. As Brightwell puts her gloves on, I don my own face mask and gloves and accept the automatic rifle she hands me. Without a word, we march quickly out of the command post. Two other suited army soldiers fall in behind us. We proceed directly to the barracks on the edge of the city, farthest away from the herd. Min and Grigori arrive there just as we do. Min recognizes me only by the name tag on my suit. They're coming. We know, I say. Get inside. Have you seen Izumi? He asks quickly. No, she's probably in the infirmary. He turns in that direction, but I catch his arm. There's no time, Min. Get inside. We'll look for her after. As they dash into the building, I glance up at the ripples in the canopy. At that moment, a screech calls out in the din, a wild, unnatural call like nothing I've ever heard. It makes my skin crawl, like hearing nails on a chalkboard. The Ereks have seen the wall of fire. Are they diverting? I hope so. It might be our only chance. Brightwell motions for the two suited soldiers to take up positions at opposite ends of the barracks. She turns to me and points toward the door to a nearby flat. I shake my head and hold up my rifle, then nod at the entrance where she's taken up position. I can't see her face, but I know she doesn't like it one bit. She simply points to the floor behind her and grips her rifle. I squat and listen, trying to make out the herd's movements. The Ereks calls are closer now, Louder. The thunder of the stampede shakes the barracks floor, bouncing tiny bits of dirt and rock near the baseboards. Time seems to slow. My heart pounds in my chest. I feel my breath pushing against the mask. My palms feel sweaty and clammy. The gun suddenly like a lead weight in my grip. But I cling tight, watching the empty streets, the shaking canopy above, and the black smoke drifting beneath and into the city. A strong gust of wind rushes past, carrying the smoke away and pulling at the canopy. Has the sandstorm reached us? Then a boom explodes through the city, the sound of the canopy fabric breaking as the first E-Rex hit it. Metal groans like a wounded animal as some of the beasts miss the openings in the canopy and strike the frame. More waves of thick black smoke roll through the city. The smell of burning grass is overpowered by a new odor, burning flesh. The E-Rex didn't make it through the field of fire unscathed. The next boom erupts from somewhere much closer. The first E-Rex has hit one of the barracks. More crashes follow, buildings crumbling as the massive animals plow into them. I wonder then if the E-Rex are still on fire. If they are, it could spread to the barracks. Our citizens hiding there would be forced to either put out the fire or flee. They would be put out in the open either way, vulnerable. That's my last thought before Brightwell spins and points at the flat behind me, motioning for me to go. When I shake my head, she sets her rifle down, grasps me by the shoulders, and spins me toward the doorway, pushing me, covering me with her body. I realize what she's doing a split second before the flat across the hall explodes. The debris slams into Brightwell's back, propelling her into me. I hit the floor hard, my hands barely breaking my fall. I expect Brightwell to roll off of me, but she lies there limp. Gently, I push up on an elbow, and she rolls onto the floor face up. Through the gloves, I can't feel her pulse. I'm reaching out to her chest to try to feel for a heartbeat when I see the E-Rex across the hall lying in the flat. It seems to be unconscious or dead. Its thick, scaly skin is black from the fire that burned it. Around the hole it made in the barracks, a few small flames still crackle, but they're going out as the wind picks up. Without warning, its eyes snap open and it springs to life, arms clawing for anything to help it stand, head thrashing back and forth like a battering ram against the walls. The entire building shakes. I freeze, my hand hovering above Brightwell's chest. She still hasn't moved. The E-Rex freezes too. And slowly, its head swings toward me, eyes raking over my body until it's staring directly at me. Directly into my eyes. Its nostrils flare as it exhales, and the warm air rushes over me.
Chapter 10. James. On the tablet, Harry smiles. The lines on his face are deeper than I've ever seen them, his skin ashy. Good luck, James. You'll come through it, if anyone can. He reaches down, taps his tablet. And the video fades to black. I wait, expecting Arthur to react, to attack me or to try to destroy the tablet or make a snide remark. At this moment, I think I would shoot him if he did. But he doesn't move. In the icy cave, he simply stares at the piles of bodies that stretch into the darkness. There was something in this cave he didn't want me to find. Was it the video? Or something else? Quickly, I scan the other files on the drive. There are no other videos. Only medical files. I can read the charts and lab results, but I'll need Izumi in order to really do anything with it. I have to get back to Jericho City. Let's go. Arthur turns to me.
Where?
Home, just like you suggested.
Might be too late for that.
What do you mean? Arthur doesn't respond. The moment drags on. Wind howls through the cave opening. The cold air blows through me like a wind tunnel in a freezer. I stow the tablet and pull on my gloves. What do you mean it might be too late? I ask again.
The storms of Eos have returned, James. You should have left when I told you.
But we're leaving now. I motion toward the entrance with the energy weapon, and Arthur begins marching. The beam from my headlamp guides our way.
I can't help but rake it over the walls, looking for the regolith sponges. As Harry said, there are none here. At the mouth of the cave, the cold is even worse. It seeps through my face mask, parka, and gloves, right down into my flesh and bones. The scene outside is beautiful. The wind carries snowflakes through the air like dandelion seeds floating by. The Spanish moss-like plants hanging from the tree limbs are coated with snow. I feel as though I've been shrunk and placed in a snow globe. Eos has never felt more alien than it does now. A stiff gust knocks sheets of snow off the trees and sends flakes flurrying. For a moment, all I see is white. I hear Arthur moving, footsteps going away from me. I raise the energy weapon. Freeze! I can't see him, but his crunching footfalls cease. If he's going to make a move on me, now would be the time. His disembodied voice is calm. If we don't move, we'll both freeze, James. The wind dies down, and when I can see Arthur again, I realize he's halfway to the ATV. Usually when I return to Jericho City from the dark side, I put Arthur back into the landing capsule and arm the explosives. It's an insulated prison cell, and it has been effective at containing him. Now, however, I feel that I might need his help. Emma, Allie, Sam, and Carson could be in danger at this very moment. You're coming with me. He raises his eyebrows. Not back into the cage? Not this time. I mount the ATV and motion for him to walk ahead of me. He trudges through the forest far more slowly than he's capable of. Get a move on, I call out. He says nothing, but increases his speed slightly. I draw the radio from my backpack. Jericho, this is James. Do you copy? The forest is silent except for the sound of the ATV tracks crunching in the snow, Arthur's footfalls, and the wind barreling through the massive trees. The gusts are gaining strength. Pieces of the moss-like substance fall around us. Jericho, do you copy? I'm within range. Why aren't they responding? I push the ATV closer to its top speed and shout to Arthur, Move it! The dense forest changes to snow-covered shrubs as we climb into the shadow of the mountain peaks. It's darkest here, but soon we'll crest the ridge and see into the valley. When we're high enough to clear the tree canopy, I feel a strong wind at my back. I turn and get my first glimpse of a storm raging on the dark side. It's like nothing I've ever seen. It's a wall of snow, churning and spinning. A white hurricane on land. That's the first thought I have. A wide river lies beneath it, icy plains on each side. And it's coming this way. If it crosses the mountains into the valley, it'll be trouble for the city. If it catches me, I'll have to try to find a cave to hide in and ride it out. I press Arthur harder after that. We bound through the rocky pass, finally arriving at a lake. It's the source of two rivers, one flowing into the valley, the other flowing into the dark side. The path around the lake is narrow and sparse. Today there's a thick film of fog hanging over the lake, as if it's a volcano about to erupt. About halfway around the lake, I hear thunder in the distance. But this thunder doesn't stop. It drones on, growing louder. On the other side of the lake, I peer down into the valley. The eastern jungle is still and quiet. But the canopy of the western jungle shakes. The leaves, green, blue, and purple, ripple like a body of water. What's happening? What I see beyond the western jungle makes my mouth run dry. A wall of sand, churning and spinning. It shines brown, gold, and blood red with the light from Eos's star. It's like a sand monster burning through the jungle. And behind me lies a storm of ice, also marching on the valley. What's happening? I ask Arthur quietly. I told you. Tell me again. The storms of Eos have returned, James. You should have gone home.
Chapter 11. Emma. Inside the barracks, it's dead quiet. The E-Rex stares at me through the open door of the flat. My hand hovers over Brightwell's chest. I'm terrified to move. The flames on the beast's back are dying down, the wind extinguishing them. Still, the stench of burned flesh assaults my nostrils and turns my stomach. but I don't flinch. I don't dare make a move. Outside, the stampede grows louder. The thunderous sound rumbles through my body. The herd seems to bring the wind with it. The gusts turn to gale force, blowing through the city like a twister through a prairie town, tearing off loose pieces of the barracks and rolling debris through the streets. My heart beats in my throat as I stare down the E-Rex. Through the din, a voice calls out, "Emma!" It's Grigori, yelling from the flat 2 doors down. The E-Rex snaps its head toward the sound.
"Emma!" he calls again. "Are you all right?"
The E-Rex raises its arms and claws at the interior walls, trying to free itself from the thick exterior wall it crashed through. Quickly, I make my choice. I jerk my hand away from Brightwell. If she's dead, there's nothing I can do. If she's unconscious and alive, I want her to stay that way. I lean forward and crawl out of the flat.
"Emma!"
Grigori calls out again. Reaching out into the hallway, I grab my rifle and bring it to my shoulder. I train the sight on the E-Rex's head and yell as loud as I can. "Hey!" As it spins toward me, I pull the trigger. The gun kicks like a mule. My shoulder throbs as the rounds hit the E-Rex. The beast cries out loudly enough to blow out my eardrums. With the noise of the herd and wind around me, I feel like I'm in the center of a hurricane. Blood pours from gunshot wounds on the E-Rex's neck and head, but the giant animal is still alive and mad. It roars again, mouth open, and finally breaks free from the wall, its back legs propelling it toward me. I pull the trigger again.
Chapter 12. James. The blue-green field that stretches from Jericho City to the western jungle is covered with a thick cloud of black smoke. But as the clouds shift, I glimpse the charred expanse below. They burned the field. A few small fires are still burning. Through gaps in the black cloud, I spot E-Rex stampeding across the black soil, disappearing beneath the canopy of Jericho City, which now has a dozen large rips in it. The fabric ripples as E-Rex crash into the frame. Still holding the binoculars, I activate the radio. "Jericho, this is James. Do you copy?" No response. A thought seizes me. What if the sound of the radio puts them in danger? If they're still in the city, they're hiding from the E-Rex. I pan around with the binoculars, looking for clues to what's happening. But the action in Jericho City is shrouded under the vast canopy and the cloud of smoke. I scan the eastern jungle. At a break in the tree cover, I see an ATV pulling a trailer full of people. Kids and elderly, mostly. Adults with backpacks jog behind them. They're evacuating. And they're heading toward the eastern mountains, to an emergency evacuation cave we identified weeks ago. It likely has the regolith sponges. Beyond the entrance, beyond where the scout team ventured in during their brief survey. I have to warn them, even if it risks giving away their position to the E-Rex. "Jericho, do you copy? Do not take refuge in the caves in the eastern mountains. I repeat, do not go to the caves in the eastern mountains." I wait, but there's no response. For 5 minutes, I repeat the warning, watching as the E-Rex herd dwindles and the smoke slowly clears from the field. Standing at the edge of the cliff above the valley, Arthur turns to me.
"You should have gone home when you could, James."
"What do you know about all this? Tell me."
"Nothing to tell, James."
"Is this what the Eye of the Grid sees?"
He smiles. "The Eye sees everything."
I'm sick of his cryptic answers and double talk. "Let's go."
"Home? It seems your neighbors are partying on your lawn again. Best to wait."
"We're going to the cave."
He raises his eyebrows.
"Cave? The evac cave. It probably has the regolith sponges."
"Bad idea.
We're gonna make sure no one reaches it. Now go."
Reluctantly, he turns and begins down the mountain. The sound of the herd grows louder as we descend. At the tree line at the base of the mountain, the sound fades significantly, as if the forest is an insulated sound booth. In contrast to the sunlight at the lake, the forest feels dark and cold, almost like the far side of Eos. Creatures call and crawl around me, as if every single part of this jungle is alive, They all seem to be in motion, flowing by me, going south. Why? This valley was here for billions of years before we arrived. It has its own rhythms, seasons, and supercycles. More than ever, I feel like a visitor here. A colonist in a foreign land, in over my head. As we travel through the dense jungle path I cut months ago, I try the radio periodically. There's never a response. Behind me, the wind picks up, a cool breeze that rustles the canopy and sends the animals scurrying faster. The faint rumbling of the herds grows, echoing through the forest. The Erex are reaching deeper into the eastern jungle. "We shouldn't be out here," Arthur says over the noise. "The storm has breached the mountains. It'll come fast now." "Suggestions?" "We need to take cover. The herd will be on us before the storm, but we can't survive either one."
"No, we don't stop until we reach the cave."
"James,
if those colonists are going there, they'll die. I'm not going to let that happen."
Arthur shakes his head, but he bounds forward, running now. The wind howls at our backs. Icy rain pelts the forest canopy, then breaks through, falling like ice water blended and poured down on me. Leaves and twigs fall with it. I push the ATV harder, standing as I ride, leaning forward. Arthur leads me, running flat out with no further goading required. The wind grows colder. The icy rain morphs into sleet and snow, and suddenly it's coming down in sheets. The roar of the herd grows ever louder. I glance down at the tablet. At my current speed, I'm 30 minutes from the cave. It'll be close. A branch above me snaps in the wind and crashes to the ground behind me. Through the din, I think I hear a voice calling my name. I glance around, but all I see is ice and jungle. The wind catches me, almost throwing me off the ATV, but I cling tight, grinding my teeth. Just a little longer. The voice comes again, faint, blotted out by the sleet and hail pelting the everything around me. I realize then what it is. The radio. Emma's voice. I'm pulling the radio from my pack when a gust catches me and throws me from the ATV into a thorny shrub at the base of a tree. Above me, limbs crack one after another, the sound like an automatic rifle firing in the snow-covered jungle. Through the white, I barely get a glimpse of the limbs before they bury me. The world goes dark, and the voice fades away with the herd and the wind.
Chapter 13. Emma. The sound of the automatic rifle is deafening. It pounds my shoulder as it fires. Metal casings shower the ground, chiming like a slot machine paying out a jackpot. The rounds dig into the E-Rex's neck and mouth. Blood pours out as it screams. Then suddenly it collapses and falls silent. The gun clicks, and I release the trigger. I'm breathing so fast, I might hyperventilate. The only sounds now are the herd and the wind, both growing louder. On my hands and knees, I crawl back to where Brightwell lies face up on the floor of the flat. She's breathing. It's shallow, but she's breathing. "Tara," I whisper. She doesn't move. "Grigori," I call as quietly as I can.
"I'm here.
Everyone okay?"
"Sort of,"
he says. I don't like that response, but there isn't much I can do at this point. "Stay where you are, and stay covered." I crawl back to the hall and grab both rifles. Glancing down the corridor, I see one of the other two soldiers peeking his head out of one of the flats. They took cover. Good. Back in the flat, I take a magazine from Brightwell's pocket and reload the empty rifle, then cradle the other one, pointing it out the doorway, ready to fire. Outside the barracks, the E-Rex pound the streets of Jericho City. Through the thunder of the stampede, I hear a man cry out. More voices join his. A woman, another man, then a chorus. A few seconds later, they all stop. I swallow hard, heart beating fast. More than anything, I want to go out there. But I can't. I'd be trampled, and I might draw attention to the barracks. The flat I'm in is a standard family unit with a queen bed on one wall and two bunk beds on the other. A table sits under the only window. Gently, I pull Brightwell toward the queen bed and slide her under it. Her head rolls toward me and she whispers, but I can't make out the words. "Just rest," I tell her. As I pull the mattress off one of the bunk beds and position it on the side of the bed, blocking any debris from hitting her. Careful not to make any noise, I turn the table on its side and take up position behind it, rifle ready. A second later, the barracks seem to explode. Two, maybe three Ereks collide into the building, screaming and clawing. I hear more shouts from another barracks. I grip the rifle. Two more crashes. They come faster then, Ereks colliding with the building and with the other beasts stuck in the side of the barracks. The thunder of the stampede is deafening. This is the main body of the herd. To my left, I hear one of the animals break free, cross the hall and begin destroying the flat next to mine, trying to escape the barracks. The bunk beds crumble, but the back wall holds as the beast bashes it with its head. It can't go forward, so it turns to its left, bashing into the wall that joins this flat. After a half dozen blows, the wall cracks, splits, and finally bursts open. Two Ereks hands reach through the opening and begin clawing at the air. I raise the rifle.
Chapter 14. James. I wake to darkness and a cold I've never felt before, even at the depths of the long winter. The chill goes right down to my organs, seeming to freeze me from the inside. I reach out, but my hand hits solid ice. The ache throughout my body is agonizing. It's as though I've been beaten nearly to death and left in a coffin of ice. "Arthur!" The word comes out scratchy and weak. "Arthur!" Stronger this time, but the sound simply bounces around in the dark like an echo chamber. "Arthur!" A hand breaks through the ice, bringing light with it and a rush of cold air. The sporadic sound of their clawed feet beating on the jungle floor surrounds me. The hand touches my chest and slides upward. "Arthur, what—" "Be quiet," he hisses. I try to sit up, but the pain in my ribs overwhelms me just as Arthur's hand slams me back down. I grip his hand with one of mine, then throw a fist through the layer of ice into the open. Instantly, Arthur moves his hand to my neck and squeezes. He is 10 times stronger than me, but I fight him, squirming and pulling at his arm with both of my hands. His grip tightens. I gasp, clawing at him, feet kicking, but he doesn't relent. Darkness comes, slowly at first, then all at once, as if I've slipped off the edge into a hole I'll never return from.
Chapter 15. Emma. The short burst from my rifle rips through the Erex's arms. It instantly draws back from the crack in the wall, then surges forward, head first, into the breach, widening it until I can see the animal's massive red eyes staring at me. A bolt of fear surges through me as I pull the trigger again. A crash explodes through the room. Another Erex, trying to get through the barracks, has blasted into the adjacent flat. Screeches and moans follow as the two beasts engage each other. The barracks shakes. The floor rumbles. The wall cracks and pieces crumble. To my right, the mattress I put beside the queen bed falls to the floor. Brightwell crawls out, moving sluggishly at first, then pausing to listen. Through the crack in the wall, she sees the two Erex fighting. She quickly motions for me to follow her out into the hall. I hold my hands up, silently asking what she's thinking, but she ignores me, moving out, regaining some of her speed and dexterity. In the hall, I get my first look at what's become of the barracks. Roughly half of the flats on the outer side lie open, their walls demolished from the animal impacts. The floor is covered in blood. Ereks lie dead in the doorways, trampled and cut up from the shards of the building. Brightwell scampers to the utility closet in the middle of the barracks. Inside are a large water recycler and a rack for cleaning supplies and toiletries. She squats, grunting against the pain, and throws open a trap door. "The crawl space," I whisper. "Only safe place," she replies, voice strained. Go. I'll get the others. Before I can protest, she's gone. I drop the rifle into the dark pit, then quickly climb down the short ladder, only using a few rungs. The space is about 4 feet tall, with water pipes snaking to the shared bathrooms. The floor above shakes as an E-Rex bounds over the barracks. These are the stragglers, the ones trailing the main herd. Another E-Rex hits the building. This time, the floor joists grind and buckle. 20 feet away, an E-Rex foot plunges through the floor and quickly jerks back above. Staying low, I move to the back wall, farthest from the direction from which the herd is approaching. Why didn't I think of telling everyone to hide down here before, instead of in the flats? How many lives did that bad decision cost us? I can't think that way. All I can do is make the best decision I can in the moment, and prepare myself to make better decisions in the future. Agonizing about them after the fact accomplishes nothing. Another set of feet descend the ladder. Grigori, his face is bloody, but he gives me a tired smile. Min follows, then the rest of the command post team. They're battered, weary, and scared, but they're all alive. We huddle at the rear foundation wall, watching the floor above. Suddenly, the thunder of the herd starts up again, and their feet pound the floor. It's a small group, not as large as the main herd, but sizable nonetheless. The E-Rex come in waves after that, more straggling groups of varying sizes. The floors are soon warped. Debris spills down through the holes. Pieces of the walls, bunks, and personal effects our friends and neighbors left behind. As the herds dwindle, the wind picks up, whistling as it blows across the broken barracks and through the holes in the floor. A loud pop makes me wince. It takes me a second to realize what it is. The canopy. The wind has snapped it off of its frame. Even the E-Rex only made holes in it, near ground level. The wind is now strong enough to tear it away. It must be 60 miles per hour or more. The whistle becomes a howl, bringing hard rain with it, pelting the crumbled barracks above us. Debris crashes into the building, an endless flow of collisions as the wind grinds away at what's left of Jericho City. The walls buckle and fall. Furniture slides across the floor, piling more and more on top of us. The storm is destroying our home. I just hope we survive it. We can always rebuild.
Chapter 16. James. I wake to a loud crack that I think is lightning. It's dark and cold, but not as frigid as before. My face is soaked, body aches. Another crack, followed by something crashing to the ground near me. By degrees, my eyes adjust to the darkness. Ice still surrounds me. Dim light oozes from above. The tree branches encased in ice remind me of veins just under the skin. I'm in a one-person igloo. It's trapping my body heat. It's probably the only reason I'm alive. I realize now what happened. Arthur did this. When the tree limbs fell and knocked me unconscious, he packed ice around them, making this protective shell. It's a genius idea. It not only kept me warm out here, but the thick ice hid my body heat from the E-Rex and kept me safe from falling debris. Another limb crashes to the ground near me. I don't hear the wind anymore, but its damage continues to cascade through the jungle. How long have I been out? It could have been hours, or even the entire night. I realize now that Arthur actually saved me a second time when I woke up earlier. He choked me to knock me out again. He was afraid my sound and body heat might draw the attention of the E-Rex. He could have killed me, but he stopped cutting off my air when I lost consciousness. I wonder why he saved me, and why he didn't want me to see Harry's video. For the life of me, I have no idea how to make any sense of his actions. After the cave, I was sure he was slowing me down, hoping I would get trapped out here in the storm and in the path of the herd. But when that happened, he came to my rescue. Why? It remains a complete enigma to me. I need to solve that puzzle. I sense that my survival, and the colony's survival, depends upon it. Even now, our fate is linked to the grid. But at the moment, another danger is more threatening. The cave. I have to warn Emma about the sponges. My backpack is gone.
Arthur must have removed it when I was unconscious. I bet he turned the radio off to silence it. The heat from the tablet might also have drawn the herd. I reach down and feel Harry's drive in my pocket. If someone has been infected with the Regolith disease, the data on this drive may be our only chance of saving them.
Arthur,
I whisper into the darkness. Outside the shelter, a gust rustles the fallen limbs and debris. Another cool drop of water falls to my face.
Arthur,
I call out a little louder. Footsteps approach, and his hand breaches the ice with a quick crunching sound. He stops short of touching me, and he draws his hand out and bends over, one eye peering down at me.
The storm?
I ask. Past, for now. The herd? Also past. There are stragglers, though, and wounded animals lying about.
We need to get out of here.
He nods and begins pulling the limbs and ice from the makeshift shelter, tossing them to the jungle floor in whooshes. When he's finished, he offers a hand. I wince in pain as he pulls me to my feet. I'm awestruck at what I see. A thick layer of fog fills the air, but the gaps reveal the storm's destruction. The jungle's canopy is completely broken. What had been a thick ceiling of limbs and leaves is now mostly open air. Around me, only the sturdiest trees are still standing. The rest, still massive, lie across the ground, half buried in the snow. Around and beneath them, the bodies of Erex litter the landscape, their glassy eyes staring into the fog that rolls over them. I count a dozen of the fallen beasts, killed by the stampede or the trees that fell upon them. A falling branch draws my attention. I watch, but there's no further movement, just a wave in the cloud of fog. The Erex are the danger out here now. They can see just fine through this fog. They'll see me from far away, and hear me. I wish I had more than the energy weapon, but I didn't have reason to expect an Erex encounter. They've never breached the eastern jungle before. A bear-like creature with three eyes is the apex predator here, and they only attack humans if their young are threatened. I spot my backpack beneath a pile of limbs next to the now deconstructed ice shelter. Its back is torn open. I reach in and feel the pieces of the radio. It's busted beyond what I can repair out here. So is the tablet. I extract a protein bar and wolf it down. I didn't realize how hungry I was until I saw it. There's another crunch in the darkened forest, but I don't see any branches falling or movement in the cloud of fog. Arthur eyes it for a long moment before turning away, silently concluding that it's not a threat.
The ATV,
I whisper. Crushed. The fog overhead parts, and a ray of sunshine lances down, briefly illuminating the space between Arthur and me. His face is half covered in dirt and scratches. His clothes are torn. What happened to him? He should have been able to shut his body down, to hide his heat signature from the Erex. Did he take shelter? Or did he defend me?
You saved me.
His gaze drifts over to me. Don't ruin this lovely moment by getting sentimental, James.
I'm not, I'm being logical, and logically it doesn't make sense.
It will.
When?
Soon.
I thought you just wanted to get off this planet, to get back to the grid.
I do.
And why don't you?
He takes the water bottle from the pack and pockets some protein bars. We're wasting time. Let's go. Keep that gun ready, and hope it works on the Erex. He sets off into the fog, stepping carefully, trying to be quiet. I take the last bite of the protein bar, shove the wrapper in my pocket, and fall in behind him, still turning the mystery over in my head. Arthur saved me. Arthur wants to leave Eos. Harry found something Arthur didn't want me to see. How does it all connect? Suddenly Arthur freezes. He throws a hand up, urging me to stop. His hearing and sight are far better than mine. He's seen something. I hear it then. A branch snapping, leaves rustling. The clouds part, and an Erex breaks into a full run, head forward, massive mouth open, teeth gleaming.
Chapter 17. Emma. Shafts of sunlight pour through the holes in the floor above, It's cold and damp down here in the crawlspace. We're huddled against the foundation wall, crouched just above the pool of water left by the rain. The ground beneath us is sealed with a thick rubber sheet. There are drains spaced throughout, but I think they're clogged with debris from above. We considered making holes in the rubber sheet, but decided against it. Any sound might draw the E-Rex. Despite the shafts of light shining down, the water is frigid, like a swimming pool in a cellar. The wind and rain have gone now. Occasionally a gust blows across the broken barracks above. For hours we listened as the storm moved through the settlement and moved south, following the river. I wonder if it has dissipated now, or just moved on. It's been impossible to sleep down here. First, there was the noise of the stampede and the storm and the crashing debris, then the cold water pooling beneath us. This long night has been an exercise in endurance, squatting and leaning against the wall, waiting. I fell asleep a few times, but snapped awake before I hit the water. We're all tired and agitated. In the dim light, I had a chance to examine the wounds on Brightwell's back and remove the shards of debris. She's bruised and cut, but she'll be all right. The knot on her head is my biggest concern. I want Azumi to take a look soon, assuming Azumi is alive. She was at the med center. I hope she thought of the crawl space. I hope those in the other barracks did too. I think it's time to take a look, Brightwell whispers. I nod and we both don our masks and gloves. Brightwell's suit is torn, but I'm hoping it will provide enough cover against any E-Rex that might be lurking out there. She wades through the water, still crouched. Pieces of plastic and wood float on the surface like the remains of a shipwreck at sea. Gregorian men make to follow us, but she waves them off. Only she and I and two of her soldiers have the infrared blocking suits. She signals for those two troops to follow us. As I suspected, the trapdoor leading up into the utility closet is blocked, likely covered with wreckage. Brightwell moves to one of the wider holes in the floor and motions for the two suited soldiers to form steps with their hands. She and I balance in the makeshift stirrups and climb out. Her first, then me. She grunts, which means she must be feeling immense pain. Crouched on the floor of the barracks, I scan the city. What I see breaks my heart into a million pieces. The barracks lie in crumbled heaps. The black solar cells from the roof mix with the white hard plastic tiles and assorted debris from inside. It's as though I'm back at Camp 7, staring at the aftermath of the asteroid strikes. Our city is ruined. There's no question about what our first priority is. We have to find our people. Between the piles of rubble that used to be our homes, fog covers the landscape, moving slowly to the east. Above, the metal spine of the canopy glimmers in the sunlight like the bones of this carcass of a city. Through a break in the fog, I spot the canopy material lying in the charred field, a torn and wadded-up white flag in the smoldering black expanse. The city is silent except for the occasional sound of debris settling. The fog hides the jungle around us, but I hear no movement there either. It's like this whole valley is crouched, like Brightwell and me, waiting, hoping the worst is over. In the quiet, she whispers a single word to me. Orders? Before the storm, I made a mistake. My orders were too specific. I assumed hiding on the far side of the barracks was the safest place. The crawl space would have been far better. I can't go back and change that decision, but I can improve with this decision. This time, I'm going to issue a general objective and ask Brightwell how it should get done. I want to secure the survivors and prepare for further storms and stampedes. When that's done, we need to make contact with the cave, then go there as soon as possible. Recommendations? Recommend we drain the crawl spaces of the four most structurally sound barracks. We'll stock them and use them as fallback shelters. I nod, and Brightwell leans over the hole in the crawl space and whispers to the two troops below. Get the rest of the CP team out and begin search and rescue. Walking quietly, we make our way to the remains of the command post. The domed building is a crumbled ruin. I'm once again reminded of the aftermath of Camp 7 as I begin digging through the rubble, trying as best I can to quietly set the shattered pieces aside. Around me, the command post staff begin scurrying between the barracks, calling out in low voices to survivors. Finally, I reach what I'm looking for, a radio that's intact. I check the channel and switch it on. "Evac team, Jericho, do you read?" I wait, watching the search efforts. I'm relieved to see a soldier emerging from a hole in the floor of one of the other barracks. They thought of the crawl space, too. "Evac, Jericho, do you copy?" A fog cloud drifts by, and I catch a glimpse of Min and Grigori searching the wreckage of the med habitat. It's larger than the command post, but just as battered. Min is calling out, his voice carrying. Grigori wraps his hands around Min's shoulders, urging him to lower his voice. Grigori has been there before. At Camp 7, he and James searched the wreckage of the Olympus building, only to find Lena dead. I bet this feels similar to him. Except now he's watching his friend, Min, live the same nightmare. "Evac, Jericho, do you read? Please respond." More than anything, I want to hear my sister's voice, or Alex, or David, or Abby. I want to know that my children are okay, that my friends have lived, that the people I was charged with protecting made it, at least some of them. Brightwell's troops are sorting the living and wounded from the dead. Which group will be larger? "James, Jericho, do you copy?" James doesn't respond either. Standing in the foggy, ruined city, I wonder if I'll ever see him or my family again.
Chapter 18. James. The Erex extends its hands, reaching for me as it leans forward. I stagger back, trying to draw the energy weapon from my pack. My hands feel like they're made of jello. My foot catches on a fallen limb and I topple backward, arms flailing. The thick parka helps to break my fall, but my head still slams into a fallen tree trunk. The beast roars. I reach again for the energy weapon, but I'm too late. The beast is 6 feet from me, mouth open, close enough for me to see its back teeth. In a flash, something collides with the Erex, latching onto its neck and hanging tight. It's Arthur. With one hand around the beast's neck, he raises his other hand, which holds a broken limb about 2 feet long. He plunges the spike into the animal's right eye with lightning speed and perfect accuracy. The Erex lets out a sickening howl and bucks like a rodeo bull trying to throw Arthur off. The android holds tight, removing the spike and plunging it into the other eye, bringing the Erex to the ground. A gurgling sound emanates from its throat as it dies. Arthur rolls off and crouches as Erex calls erupt throughout the jungle. The entire forest seems to come alive, bushes rustling, fallen trees and limbs cracking, the remains of the canopy swaying as if the battle cries have set off 100 unseen armies. "Take cover," Arthur hisses to me. He crouches, his head swiveling like a radar dish trying to pinpoint a sound. Suddenly, he snaps around to his right. An Erex lunges for him, clamps onto his right arm with its teeth, and tears it away.
Chapter 19. Emma. In the wreckage of Jericho City, the dead lay in piles. The living are huddled together in groups of 50, scarfing down the meager meals we salvaged from the wreckage of the mess hall. Our crops to the south near the river are ruined, burned, and trampled. Food will become an issue soon. There's still been no word from James, or those who evacuated to the cave. The evac team was told to turn their radios off during transit, for fear the noise might draw the Erex. But I expected them to turn them back on in the cave. Yet still they aren't responding. There's been some good news. Min and Grigori found Izumi, and her patients in a barracks near the medical habitat. Izumi has her hands full with the wounded. She's moving between the groups, taking stock and prioritizing care. I've also been moving around, trying to reassure people that we're doing the best we can. Many of the residents are separated from their families. All of them are tired, hungry, and scared. Our biggest concern now is the herd doubling back, passing through Jericho City as they return to their natural habitat in the western jungle. The eastern jungle is cooler than they're used to. They won't stay there any longer than they must. As such, we're prepared to retreat back into the crawl spaces, which are slowly draining. Brightwell has sent a team of her troops into the western jungle to look for the soldiers she sent there to try to divert the herds. Near the command post, she stands with her radio to her ear, the speaker at the lowest setting. I hear only phrases, but one catches my attention. KIA. Killed in action. As long as I've known her, Brightwell's face has always been a mask, rarely betraying emotion. But now the facade cracks for a moment as sadness overcomes her. A cloud passes through the ruined city, obscuring her. When it clears, the mask has returned. I finish making my rounds in the current group of survivors, then return to Brightwell, who seems deep in thought. I'm sorry about your people. She stares at the eastern jungle. Thank you. How are the civilians? Shaken up? Ready to get out of here? We need to send a team to the cave. Our first priority is recovering the vehicles so we can transport the remaining population and our food. I raise my eyebrows. You see us staying there for a while? Days? Or weeks? I'd recommend we stay until this storm season passes, however long that takes. Brightwell motions to the city. We can't be out here in the open when those herds are on the move. I agree, but food will become an issue. True, but for now, evacuating is the bigger issue. I'm going to lead a team to the cave, make sure the path is clear. I have 3 troops left here with suits. I'll take all of them with me. I've also found about 1/2 of the special ops team members I sent into the western jungle. We're going to bring their bodies back here and use their suits, assuming they fit other soldiers. Those troops will stay here to guard the civilians. I'm coming with you. Ma'am, I have one of those suits. I killed an E-Rex in the barracks last night. I'm not saying it was a SEAL team level takedown, but I managed. I'll follow your orders out there. I can't put you in danger, ma'am. There's nothing more I can do here. I need to know that my family is okay. You know you can use an extra set of hands out there. And my suit doesn't fit any of your troops. I've been looking around. I'm going. She nods, probably realizing that arguing will only waste more time. At the remains of the armory building, Brightwell begins digging through the rubble until she reaches a metal locker. I help remove the rest of the debris covering it, allowing her to pry the door open. I wince at the sound of the metal groaning, and we both pause, eyes scanning around us for movement. Thankfully, the plane is silent and still. Brightwell pulls a backpack from the locker. She unzips it and draws out a metal ball the size of a small apple. "Do you know what this is?" she asks, extending the device to me. "A grenade." "We have 3. I brought them against my orders." "Good. Take one. Use it only if you have to." "How do I know when that is?" "If the time comes, you'll know it."
Chapter 20. James. Lying on the damp ground, I watch in horror as the E-Rex rips off Arthur's arm. The android's empty shoulder socket sparks. Wires hang free. The E-Rex chomps down on the severed limb, then pauses, seemingly confused by what it's bitten into. That pause gives me the opening I need. Hands shaking, I draw the energy weapon and train it on the E-Rex. I have 1 shot, and only 1 shot. If I miss, Arthur and I are both finished. As the creature spits out the arm, I pull the trigger, sending a white beam into the E-Rex's chest. The beast squawks before going rigid and collapsing. I have no idea how long it will be unconscious. I don't intend to find out. Arthur has the same thought. He bounds over to me, ignoring the mangled arm he lost. He leans toward the ground and whispers, "Get on my back." I can't help but glance down at the energy weapon in my hand. Since I brought Arthur to the surface, I've always kept this loaded weapon with me in case he tried to attack me. It was my only countermeasure against him. Now it's gone. What's more, I'm not even sure I ever needed it. Arthur just saved my life. Again. Why?
James, hurry. More are coming.
Reluctantly, still clutching the weapon, I climb onto his back. He dashes through the jungle, leaping over the massive fallen trees, ducking vines and branches, and adjusting course seemingly at random, parting the fog as he goes. He can see the E-Rex moving through the dense forest. I can only hear the foliage rustling and branches snapping as they close on us. Suddenly, Arthur changes course again, running faster now. The ground beneath him disappears as he leaps across a gully. Fallen trees lie across it like balance beams over a ravine. On the far bank, he slings me off his back and pushes me down into the wide ditch.
"Get down," he urges. "I'll hide you."
Near the bottom of the gully, a tree lies on its side, its roots in the air, leaving a massive hole. Arthur shoves me into the crevice and begins raking dirt and snow over me. He tears off a piece of his shirt, and I close my eyes as he lays it over my face. The damp soil and ice fall upon me. I feel like a man being buried alive. I don't dare open my eyes, but I hear Arthur dash away. In the distance I hear him yell, "Who's afraid of the one-armed man?" He's drawing the E-Rex away, and the loss of his arm didn't take his sense of humor with it.
Chapter 21. Emma. The path to the emergency cave is littered with fallen trees and branches, and beneath all that are the deep ruts the ATVs left during their frantic rush from Jericho City. We've also found a collection of trinkets dropped along the way. A knit cap, a bag of food, a child's teddy bear. They're like breadcrumbs leading the way. At the end of this trail, we'll find out whether our loved ones survived the trip. In my mind, I keep picturing Sam, Allie, and Carson huddled together in the dark cave, wondering why I haven't arrived. That is, assuming they're still alive. With each step, I'm terrified that we'll start finding bodies. Around me, Brightwell and her troops march carefully through the jungle, rifles at the ready. Every sound draws their attention. We stop and squat every few minutes, eyes trained on the disturbance. I always expect to see an E-Rex, but we haven't encountered one yet. Perhaps they were all driven deeper into the eastern jungle. I hope so. They won't cross the mountains to the dark side. At least, they never have. It's too cold there. The river to the south of us is too wide for them to cross. They can't swim. Which means they have to still be here, in this jungle, lurking. Or resting. Waiting to return to the far side of the western jungle, bordering the desert. I expected Brightwell and her troops to clear the fallen trees on the path. The jungle is too dense for the ATVs to go around them. Instead, they merely step over them. It makes sense. She's going to gather more troops at the cave and return for the task. It's the right move. There's strength in numbers. For now, our sole priority is reaching the cave. In the distance, I hear an E-Rex roar. It bellows again, then suddenly stops. Another beast calls out, a different one, I think. There's a pop. Not like a tree snapping, more like something metal breaking. Brightwell stops in her tracks, turning toward the sound. A bizarre hiss follows. The sound is faint. It's unnatural, more like a laser than an animal call. What could it be? One of the soldiers takes a step toward the sound, but Brightwell catches his arm and shakes her head. For a long moment, the jungle is still and quiet, as if waiting to discover who or what is making the sound. Suddenly, I hear movement all around us, from the north, south, east, and west. Massive animals, most likely E-Rex, barreling through the forest, drawn by the sound like moths to a flame. Quickly, Brightwell leads the team off the path and into a thick clump of fallen trees and brush. We crouch with our weapons ready, listening as the jungle thumps with the sound of Erek's feet beating the ground. The thinned-out canopy above shakes from the movements. Erek's roar every few seconds. Amid the cacophony, I hear a voice yelling something, but the sound is too faint to make out. Is it James? I don't think so. One of the civilians or soldiers we evacuated? Or possibly someone who left the city when the herds came through? Doubtful. They would have been trampled by the stampede. The voice calls out again, the tone almost taunting. It's familiar, but I can't place it. Whoever it is would have to be crazy to call out in this jungle filled with predators. Crazy or desperate. I lean forward and focus on Brightwell. We're both wearing our face masks, which cover our eyes, so I can't see her expression and she can't see mine. But we know each other pretty well by now, and she interprets my unspoken question.
We can't help them, she whispers. There are too many Ereks.
She pauses,
and I think whoever it is wants to draw them. I don't think they're in trouble.
For what feels like an eternity, we crouch in the thicket in the damp, cold jungle, listening as the last of the Ereks flock away from us. I feel like I'm back in that crawl space waiting for the herd to pass. Finally, Brightwell motions for us to return to the path, and we resume our march, now with more urgency, only some of the caution gone. She probably assumes the Ereks that hurried to the disturbance might come back. She's probably right. At this point, we can't be more than 5 minutes from the cave. With every step, we get closer to finding out what happened to our loved ones. I grip the rifle, scanning in every direction. My foot snaps a twig and the group stops, one of the soldiers peering back at me. I can't see his expression through the mask, but I'm sure he's scowling. I wonder if he'd make the same fuss if one of his fellow soldiers had made the racket. Brightwell motions for us to keep going, and we resume our position through the jungle, stepping over more fallen limbs and trunks, brushing leaves out of our face. Up ahead, the point soldier freezes and holds up a hand. Everyone crouches on the path, bringing their rifles to their shoulders, panning back and forth for targets. Brightwell creeps forward, joining the point soldier, who's motioning to our left, toward a lump